Welcome to Womb Radio. I'm Paul Kavicki, better known as Pounce, the host of the Live Audio Forum. With me today is Matt Newport, who is the president, founder, CEO, and chief bigwig at Black Lion Audio in Chicago, Illinois. We're here today because I, of all things, I've had my Motu audio interface modded up at Black Lion Audio. If you don't know generally what they do, they've made their reputation most especially for taking mid-level pro audio gear, most specifically audio interfaces for computers, and improving the A to D, D to A, and or microphone preamps, and greatly improving the quality of the audio for people that are self-recording computer kind of folks, which kind of includes everybody in the music industry nowadays. So with that is a long-winded welcome. Hello, Matt.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Excellent. Very good. So would you please take it from where I just left off, and would you just give a little introduction to Black Lion Audio? Because I have to say, for the longest time, must have been, what, 1 or 2 years running now, as a person for myself, I'm fairly active just on the internet on the pro audio boards, and I've regularly at all the usual pro audio forums and in magazines like Tape Op, I have heard uniformly good, if not just out and out glowing praise of what Black Lion Audio has been able to do with interfaces that are actually affordable for regular humans. So could you tell us about what Black Lion Audio is doing and your history and how you've gotten to be, well, the Black Lion Audio that we know now.
Wow. Well, thanks for the thanks for the compliments. That's nice. I started Black Lion Audio, I guess unofficially in October of 2003, and at the time I had. I was working on a project for a friend, like engineering a project, and we didn't have a very big budget, and so I just kind of started looking into modifying some of the equipment that we were using, and was pretty surprised at the results that I got. And then, sort of on a challenge from someone here in the city, I decided to take a look at the Alesis 3630, which is pretty infamous or notorious. I don't know whatever word you want to.
I have a different word that I would have used.
And he said, "I don't think there's any way that you can do anything with that." So I thought, "Well, I'll take a look at it." And first of all, I had a pretty hard time getting a hold of the schematics because Alesis wanted me to sign. I think they wanted me to pay $100 and sign a non-disclosure agreement. And I thought, "Well, that's ridiculous." And I ended up, somebody gave me a copy of it. Somehow. So I kind of looked through it and found that there were quite a few shortcomings in the design. So I thought, well, you know, this should be pretty interesting. So I went ahead and worked on a little bit. And I think I ended up selling a kit for it for a couple years and got reviewed in Tape Op magazine. And then next thing I knew, I had more work than I knew what to do with. And I sort of, we ended up moving into interfaces. Again, because I had a friend with that was working on a project, and I think he had a Mark of the Unicorn, and so I took a look at it and did some work on it and started offering modifications for those, and that really kind of exploded, and I think next thing I knew, I had to hire a couple of people. That's been pretty steady ever since. I think I got about 8 employees at this point, and that's over the last 2.5 years.
But there are, at this point, though, there are specific things you guys do, but you're not just a general, you won't just do any mod or anything.
No, we want to know that the stuff, we don't want to have to inherit problems that are too overwhelming for us. So when it comes to audio interfaces, of course, the big thing is how is it designed to begin with? Like, what's the platform look like? What are the software drivers like? That's a really big one. So, you know, there are certain companies' interfaces that we just would never consider touching because we don't want to inherit these software nightmares. Mark of the Unicorn, and then some of the, like, the DigiDesign LE stuff have been really the the most stable platforms we've worked with and have allowed us to grow considerably because of their popularity.
So. Is there Any similarities you think in your shop as a shop that's based on mods and compared to the work of someone like Jim Williams with his upgrades or with what Michael Joly is doing with his Octava mods? To me, you guys are serving different pieces of gear. One guy is more, you're more specifically the interfaces. One guy is more specifically mixing boards and pro audio outboard. One guy is microphones. But you seem to all be brothers in the business.
Right. In a sense, I can't speak for those guys because like Jim Williams, I've never spoken to in my life. So I don't really know much about him. But I have kind of looked at his website. I see the stuff that he works on and I kind of make it a point to not compete directly with him because there's enough stuff out there that there's no reason that I should be, you know, stepping on somebody's toes in that respect. So he's got his little line of work that he handles, and then we've got ours. And I know that Michael Joly does a lot of the same things. There's another guy named Dave Thomas. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He does like a lot of the Apex tube mics. And I think Michael Joly has kind of steered away from the stuff that Dave Thomas works on.
Yeah, his name came up because the Apex 260s?
The 460,
460s, yeah. That's the...
Nady actually made one that was fairly similar to that. I don't know much about the diaphragm, and I'm not really much of a microphone person, but I think I got a hold of one for like $60 or something like that new and put a Cinemag transformer in it. And it's decent, you know, for whatever, you know, $100 it cost me. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't hold up to the Palooza we have in the shop, but that's a pretty nice mic for the price.
The Paloozas are pretty impressive. But the other one for less than the price of a 58, that's
right.
It's not too bad.
The Paloozo stuff, I don't remember which particular model we have. We have that, and then we've got this really nice ribbon mic that Wes Dooley sent us to demo. And it's pretty nice.
I love my R84.
Yeah, that's kind of been some of our intention, I think, with modifying some of this stuff is we felt like, well, you know, there are certain things definitely that separate the mid-price stuff from the high-end stuff. You know, there's things that we, of course, can't touch, you know, certain types of noise suppression or, you know, circuit board layout or certain things like that. But we found that by rearranging the conversion circuit and improving the analog stages, we can get pretty darn close to the really high-end stuff. And in some cases, exceed some of the stuff that tends to hold like a place of respect in a lot of people's minds. And I think we were all initially surprised by that at first, but we find that the more research and development we do, the better we get. And it's just nice to be able to offer something like that for a pretty competitive price or for something that doesn't break the bank and allows you to save some money and invest in one of those nice microphones we were talking about.
Yeah, I've never thought it was strictly the case I think that's what there's a certain mini revolution going on about whether or not the price and quality always directly correlate, because there's a lot of affordable stuff that's also, it's not necessarily bad, but at best the quality control is spotty. So if you're talking about cheap mics or whatever, you've no guarantee that any two or three in a row sound at all alike.
Right, especially with the Chinese made stuff. I think that's kind of been a big issue. I think one of the things that people maybe need to realize about the pro audio industry is oftentimes you do pay for infrastructure within a company. So if a company's fairly large, you know, there's a lot of things that they have to pay for. If they've got a big advertising budget, that's got to be paid for. And you see all that stuff tucked into the price of the equipment you're buying. And it shows up as a multiple because of the way that the business model tends to work. So when you're dealing with a smaller company like us or Michael Joly or Jim Williams or, Shiny Box, guy that, did ribbon mics, mm-hmm. DAV electronics. You're paying for less infrastructure. So you tend to get something that's a little more competitive.
Well, more bang for the buck.
Advertising. Yeah. And I mean, of course, I don't know. I don't want to disparage myself or anybody else, but there's downsides to that too. Of course, we're not enormous. So, you know, we can't, we can't pay for a wonderful promotional campaign that's going to pump up the resale value of your used equipment, or, you know, or something like that. But I think for what you get, especially given the financial state of, not just the economy in general, but of the music industry, it's not the 70s anymore. It doesn't make sense to pump $1 million into a studio. You're going to have a very hard time recouping that money or justifying your expense. So, you know, we have to look for ways to sort of maximize our dollar and get the most out of the equipment that we're using.
And you barely advertise. Maybe you've advertised on Tape Op or something.
We advertised on Tape Op once. That was kind of a funny story because one of the editors wanted me to modify some equipment and he wanted to trade for an ad. And I think it was just me working at the time. I didn't even have like an ad person, you know, and so I threw together this hideous looking thing. I don't know. We definitely got some exposure from it. I didn't really pursue any advertising in the future. At the moment, we mostly advertise on Google, and then we do some advertising on Gear Sluts, I think. For the most part, we've kind of let word of mouth sort of generate the growth. And I think that's kind of, it's difficult from a business perspective because you go, well, how much growth can we squeeze out of this word of mouth thing? But then at the same time, we feel like it, as one of my friends who works in, some economic capacity, in economics or the stock market says, crowds are always a good indicator of something, you know. So if you see a bunch of people, if you hear a bunch of positive reviews, it's probably a good indication that something positive is happening.
But just from a fairly organic business perspective, and not to pry too much into your wallet per se, but but you guys, in as much as you don't advertise, you practically don't have any retailers or whatever, you guys are really doing it all yourselves, top to bottom, from word of mouth almost exclusively.
Right.
And it's all you guys, which is a pretty rough.
Yeah, and it gets challenging sometimes, I think. And it's funny that you bring that up because I think over the last couple months, we've really started to see how difficult it is. We can only take this, I think, so far in terms of like promotional skill and stuff like that. And so you go, okay, well, if I want to continue to grow, you know, like for me, a really important thing is that, you know, I have to continue to ensure some sort of economic growth because I want to make sure that my employees make a decent living, you know, especially if they're going to, you know, I got an employee who's getting married, you know, I think as an employer, it's partially my responsibility to make sure that he has enough money to run his household. So I have to look for ways to grow the company so I can afford to pay them, you know, so I can afford to pay vacations or insurance or all the things that, you know, people kind of want out of a job.
But just inferring from your story, there's been, if slow, at least steady growth from the inception of Black Line.
It hasn't been slow.
Oh,
it's been. I would say from year one to year two, I saw about 150% growth in revenue.
Nice.
Year two to year three, it has been about 300%. Well, three times. I guess that's
other businesses should be so lucky. In fact, that much growth has killed companies before.
Yeah, it's insane. It's been so incredibly difficult to keep up with and to do a good job and make sure that quality's there. I mean, it's a constant battle. So
tell me then, what is your thinking in your company's transition? Your primary reputation had been modifying the analog sections of interfaces and or the clocks, you know, improving everything that related to the audio and the interfaces. Part of that also became that you would modify the mic preamp circuits in some of the interfaces. Mm-hmm. And then I guess that came to the next logical step that you guys have for the first, is it just this year that you've introduced your own Blackline audio products that are based on things like your own clock?
Right. Well, last year we actually introduced the clock and that was based on a couple different things. We found that we used to actually modify the internal clock in Mark of the Unicorn stuff. And we found that sometimes we would run into weird conflicts with drivers or, you know, the way that the clock circuit is actually managed within the unit. And there were different revisions from what we could tell. And we had no way of telling which was which. And so we said, well, let's just take the knowledge that we've accumulated and we'll move it into a word clock and sell that. We'll bundle that with the Mark of the Unicorn stuff. That proved to be pretty interesting. It was pretty successful the first year. We sold way more than we thought we were going to. I think we moved about 400 of those things, which is surprising for any product in its first year with no real advertising budget. But we also found that we created a pretty big firestorm of controversy thanks to some of the things that some of the other designers in this industry say, which I don't know. It certainly wasn't our intention, and it got to be a little bit crazy at some
point. Well, I guess this is the right time to get geeky. Let mm-hmm. me start with this tack. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, and again, you don't have to necessarily name which manufacturers mm-hmm. or whatever if you want to still seem all friendly with yeah. everybody, but for instance, with the gear, the kind of gear that you modify now, mm-hmm. Because you started mentioning it with the Alesis 3630, mm-hmm. but all the way up to the Mode 2 and DigiDesign and mm-hmm. other interfaces, are you finding, is there any consistency to which kind of corners are being cut in mass manufacturing that you can... I don't know if is everybody just being cheap over in this one, or always using the cheapest op amp or something like that.
Well, yeah, to a degree, but I mean, at the same time, it's kind of this thing where I hesitate to sound overly critical, because mass marketing or mass producing equipment has its limitations, and you know, we might say, okay, well, since we're doing this on a boutique scale. For us to keep a stock of you know, a particular type of op amp that maybe costs us $1.20 each, that's much different than a manufacturer who's saying, well, I got to churn out 500 of these and with 25 op amps in them, and I can use the op amp that costs me 5 cents each, or I can use the op amp that costs me $1.20 each, and I have to come up with the capital outlay for that all at once. So you can see how that kind of gets a little prohibitive, like... it just raises the budget by so much money. And then, of course, again, like I mentioned before, all that stuff gets tucked into the end price as a multiple. So they have to spend more money to produce it. That means that they're going to raise the price quite a bit more, or they're going to have to increase the promotional campaign or something of that nature.
And that doesn't matter as much in high-end gear, where you presume that these concerns are addressed. It's right. In the more affordable gear
right.
that these corners are more necessarily yeah. going to be cut. So you're going to run into this limitation a lot.
Yeah, more. It's just because we've had people say, well, aren't you afraid of so-and-so stealing your idea? Well, no, not really, because it's not even economically feasible for them to do this. It just, when you're talking about that much scale, it just is... you know, there's a reason that people run things the way that they do. You
yeah,
know?
If they stole that idea, they'd sell it for three times the price
right,
of what
exactly.
you do.
Nobody would want to see it, because the rule of thumb is that the price that you pay is about five times what it actually costs to manufacture. Because the you know, of course, the manufacturer says, "Well, it costs us this much plus we need profit," and then the distributor says, "Okay, well, we want to make some money for you know for our risk. We're buying all this stock, and we're holding it in a warehouse somewhere. So we have to pay for the warehouse. We have to pay for the forklift. We got to pay for the employees. You know, all that stuff adds up. So since we work on a pretty small scale, we build to order. We just keep things a lot more simple, and the price fortunately gets reflected in that. Now the downside is that you know if we see enormous demand spike for say our A to D. Well, we're going to be struggling to keep up, you know. So there kind of comes at a point where it's difficult, because like if you get too big, then you have to change your business model. And for us as a smaller company, it's been beneficial in that respect.
How much bigger can you get? How much bigger do you presume you can get in your current business model before you have to? It looks like you're keeping your eight guys pretty busy.
Yeah, we are. We have more than we know what to do with. I'm actually looking at hiring a couple new people, one to do like administrative stuff, so I don't have to get tied up with just the things that I get tied up with, payroll and answering questions from people and dealing with state governments and all that sort of stuff. And then we'll probably be bringing on another staff engineer to help with design and troubleshooting and production and things like that.
You do have a fairly ideal warehouse space with all yeah. the workstations yeah. and then like a setup for a band and,
yeah,
and
yeah.
everybody. It's it's as cool of an atmosphere as you would hope it would be in your mind's eye when you go, how cool could that place be? This, it actually is kind of like that. Yeah, it's kind
of, I think a lot of people are surprised when they come by because they're like, oh, well, I figured you'd be working in some basement somewhere with a bunch of stuff stacked up all around you. And this looks more like an art gallery or something, you know? And that's, yeah, to me, that was actually really important to find a place like that with a lot of sunshine. And a lot of, you know, like a high ceiling and just this, a big sense of space, because I feel like it affects employee morale. It affects how people view things when they come in the door. It's just, I don't know, it just has a neat benefit. So
let's hop into the stuff. We started to talk about this before, and this is going to be more of the meat and potatoes of what people will want to listen to this kind of an interview about. You started by talking about using, in your case, you talked about using Gen X converters as one of your points of reference as to how could you take the engineering you were doing into the other interfaces? How could you try and get as positive of a comparison between them as possible, despite extremely disparate dollar amounts being involved? Can you tell me as much as you can about converters, comparisons, and your the results and your philosophies about approaching everything with response to just, you know, what is it you're achieving and what are you doing with all this stuff? And everything you told me before. Like if we could kind of loop that back around.
I'm trying to type this out for myself so I don't get lost on these long tangents like I tend to do sometimes. So let's talk about converter comparisons first. You know, on our site, we've got some comparisons between the 002, like our newest modification for the 002 and 003, the Gen X, GXA8. And I think when we first did this, we thought, because we know what the Gen X is and we know where its place is in the industry and how, you know, a lot of like mastering houses and film scoring houses that have pretty large budgets really like the Gen X. Gen X, I think, is probably one of the best sounding A to D converters I've ever come across out of all the stuff I've used. And I don't want to name anybody else's names because I don't want to offend anyone. But
it would be fair to say in our pre-interview conversation, all of the highest ones that would be highest
all
name
highest
brand ones
stuff.
Were mentioned. Yeah. We are not forgetting the big names that might be springing to your
all
mind
stuff,
right now.
Yeah, all the stuff that you've heard of that you think is like the high
stuff.
Lust factor. Yeah. Gen X is definitely up there. I think most people that work in home studio systems or in especially in the music industry don't often run into Gen X stuff. It's not a very big company, but definitely caught my eye or my ear, I guess, the first time I heard it. And I really wondered how on earth do they get this sound, because it has a very soft top end and a nice like a punchy mid, almost like, you know, for those of you that are listening, like if you've used a piece of gear with a transformer in the signal path, you know what kind of thickness it lends to the audio. And the Gen X had that, but it's, to my knowledge, it's not transformer coupled, it's just transformerless. So I set about, I had learned a few things based on how we had designed our word clock. I had learned some things about transformer coupling the digital signal path, the clock, and what an effect it had. And I still don't understand all of the physics behind it. I cannot figure out why it does this, but it just makes everything sound so thick. It really gives that punchy mid, like we were talking about earlier. You got that nice punch in the mid, the low end is real tight, and the top end doesn't sound hard. It just kind of sounds a little rolled off. So I started experimenting with transformer coupling the clock path, like at the master clock. And then I kind of messed around with like how much current are you driving that with? So not to get too technical, but I discovered that the more current you're driving the transformer with, the richer it sounds, up to a degree, because then you reach a saturation point. But so we kind of, what we did was we designed a new internal clock for the 002, and then just sort of did some A/B tests with this Gen X, and we're pretty impressed with the sound quality we got. But another thing that we do that's a, like quite a bit different is it's been common practice within our industry in terms of like converter design. What we do is we say, okay, well, here's the converter chip, and then let's connect it to its power supplies, right? You got your supply for the digital side, and you got a power supply for the analog side. And then we decouple that with some capacitors, and it's traditional to use a couple. You use one because it behaves a certain way at certain frequencies, and then you use another one because it behaves another way at other frequencies, and they're supposed to sort of offset each other, right? So one does one thing, and the other one compensates for the weaknesses that the first one has. And the drawback of that is that it actually kind of creates this weird resonance in the supply, and then that kind of crosstalks over into the audio, and you get this kind of weird resonant peak that's not, you know, you don't really want something like that. So there's a lot of newer generation components that are out there that are just incredible. They perform really well at all frequencies, and so we just started using single bypassing, like single capacitor bypassing, and we found that it just lent everything a much more natural sound, and it's not really the way that other people do it, but we felt like it sounded quite a bit more open. So that's one thing that we do that other people don't do. And I think like once you get into when you're talking about what's commercially available, for the most part, everybody sort of follows the same model. And a lot of these companies will use an external design house to do their converter design for them. And I know that they do this because one of those companies, one of the biggest ones that does this work, is right here in Chicago, and I occasionally have lunch with a couple of the guys from the company. So they tell me lots of stories. That's pretty interesting. So yeah, typically you'll find, you know, like if you were to say, well, I want to do a listening test between, say, I don't know, Apogee and Lynx, you know, you would find that they actually sound pretty similar. And chances are they're using a fairly similar circuit design. We feel that because we approach it from a fairly unique perspective, we just do things a little bit differently, that the stuff that we design sounds different. You know, it sounds more natural. It sounds more open. We find that a lot of people tend to emulate tape in particular ways by limiting the frequency band. And we don't really do that because we feel like we don't necessarily have to. And digital has certain capabilities that analog does not have, and we're trying to maximize what that's capable of and give people the sort of sonic fidelity that they wouldn't normally get. So I don't know if that's too over the top.
No, I mean, I didn't want this to be like an electrical engineering interview. Right. But there's a certain danger that people could think it sounds like straw into gold. This whole your Motu can sound just like an Apogee. Right.
No. It's totally different. It's totally different than that. It is a totally different sound. And if you do A/B comparisons, you'll hear what I'm talking about.
But I just meant in terms of price points that there would be any mod that could elevate these decidedly mid-level interfaces into something a bit better. Just that it's not snake oil. Really something
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I don't. It kind of gets tough because there's so many little aspects to it, like so much subtle nuance of how you approach the design, and sometimes it's hard to convey all of that without getting lost in tangents or whatever. So
I've noticed that on some of the more very gear-oriented pro audio websites, they are truly just nuts about spec sheets and things like that, to a point where I guess the worry becomes that they're worrying more about specs than listening,
or that
they don't have, maybe they don't have the opportunity to do a good comparative listening thing, because sometimes it really can be tough to say, like, you know, especially if you're just a regular guy instead of a big major studio. I mean, just to say, I want to hear these three different converters together in the same room, like that could be really difficult to put it together. In fact, I've heard a lot of different kind of converters, but I've rarely heard them all in the same room at the same time. I've heard them in different places.
Well, yeah, I think some of that has to do with the pricing factor. You know, it would be very expensive to pull something like that off. Another thing that it has to do with is I think that a lot of times our industry, and I don't mean to say this in a bad way, but it's just kind of like a necessity of our existence. You know, like the people who tend to review stuff most, I mean, the internet is definitely changing things, but newspaper, or not newspaper, but magazine-based
reviews
and stuff, I mean, they're, you know, they're pretty worried about their bottom line. And I think that that's very normal. I mean, if you had a magazine that was, you know, needed so many thousands of dollars a month to operate, and people's jobs depend on that. I mean, the fact of the matter is you don't want to make the wrong people mad. And I certainly cannot fault them for thinking that way. If I was in their shoes, I'd probably be just as stressed out and probably approach things from the same way. So the internet definitely gives us the ability to review products and approach things from a perspective that print media in the past hasn't really given us. I think that based on, because we've heard a lot of different converters, you know, just because we want to see, well, how does our stuff stack up? We want to make sure that we're trying to sell a product that we feel like is legitimate and forthright and honest, and we don't want to make claims of like whatever, you know, if we can't back them up.
So yeah, so you do not seem like the audiophile crowd.
Right. We get a lot of stuff in, and we're fortunate because we've developed good relationships with a lot of studios around the world who are always happy to beta test for us, you know, to do A-B samples for us. So we know what Lavery stuff sounds like. We know what Apogee stuff sounds like. We know what Lynx's Aurora line sounds like. We know what MyTech sounds like. We've used Gen X. We've heard Prism. We've heard Weiss. And also we know how they're approaching their design philosophy. I think that a lot of times people that are maybe working on a project and reading stuff on a forum, of course you go there for help, but you know, maybe sometimes like you're a little bit afraid of like, well, is this, you know, I have to follow this route or the textbook says this thing or that thing. And it's not that we want to throw that stuff out the window by any means, but we definitely want to keep it in perspective, right? So we want to say, okay, well, specs, they are important, but they are not the most important thing, because from a technical perspective, a transformer in the signal path is the worst thing you could do, but it sounds awesome. I mean, it doesn't, you know, tape from a technical perspective has terrible distortion curve, but it sounds awesome. So in a way we kind of have to, yeah, we just have to keep it in perspective and say, let's look at it from the sound quality aspect and not just the spec aspect. Because, hey, you know, specs are not going to write a great song for you.
Now, one thing I've noticed is that engineers coming into, whether it's live or studio or, you know, whatever atmosphere, a lot of them come from very different backgrounds, some of whom are, you know, come from a real strict musicians, like composing, you know, kind of a educated background. Some are just good rock and roll folks who are proper party leaders, and they set the atmosphere the right way, which is actually, I think, almost more important. Really,
yeah, that's a very admirable quality.
But what about the electrical engineering component? To what degree, you know, I'm good at soldering and a variety of basic expected tasks, but how much, and I'm going from the specs and white pages to there to like how much electrical engineering, how much is it helpful to the average engineer guy? I mean, I guess, I mean, you know, there are your Tom Dowd types that are, or, you know, or Les Paul types that were building, you know, stacking the recording heads and making their own consoles to today, where that's not so common.
That's not so common. But I mean, like if you read interviews with Les Paul, he's like, well, I didn't really know what I was doing. I just thought I'll try this and see how it sounds. You know, that there's a sort of inquisitiveness that's definitely a very admirable character trait, in my opinion. And maybe to a degree, it seems like that's less tangible today, you know, because, well, you can't put your hands on the recording head because it doesn't exist. It's in a semiconductor form inside your thing, and you have no idea what's going on.
Well, yeah, I'm starting to wonder if it's like what I hear about car repairs, where there's a certain point in time where a standard set of tools and you can get in there and work on your car, and now it's adequately computerized and miniaturized that the weekend warrior may no longer be able to do that.
Right.
In audio, I presume that there's a lot of things that now we're getting into surface-mounted proprietary chips.
DSP is like extremely difficult to do because of the programming language behind it. That's very hard to find people who know you know, exactly how that sort of stuff functions. And, but at the same time, there's a point where I think it goes too far. I read an interview once with someone, I think it might've been the guy from Pendulum Audio. And he was talking about how he was working on a recording project and he was going to build his own converter for it. And the interviewer said, "Wow, that's so awesome. I wish I could do that. That would be so cool to be able to do that." And the interview subject said, "Well, but you kind of have to pick what it is you're going to do. Like, typically what happens is you do one thing well and that's it. So, you know, maybe if you're working on a recording project and you suddenly want to take a diversion to build your own converter, well, it just never is good enough. And you keep working and keep working and keep working. And all of a sudden you've lost sight of what your original goal was." So I think it can help and it can harm too. It just is, there's a necessity for balance in everything that you do. And if you want to do the EE thing and you want to design gear, definitely go that route. But you'll find that the more you get into it, the harder it is to actually come back to what it was you were originally doing, which is making music. You know, it just is, yeah, you, especially as you get older, I think you find you do one thing and you do it well. And
I think people have asked me is now, as I've hit, you know, in a variety of ways, the high points in my career in this, I'm doing the biggest work I've done. I'm making the most money. I've got the best resume stuff. Now I come back and I make music less than I ever have.
Because isn't it amazing? Like, you find that you busy yourself with the work and... Yeah.
But what really got me going about the EE stuff is, at least anecdotally, at least just from casually observing the internet and whatnot, I have a sense that there's some sort of a resurgence in the do-it-yourself market. And I don't know, again, if this is just too many articles I've seen about Giraffe and a variety of other manufacturers that have, and what, Seventh Circle Audio, they're another one with those really interesting mic trees and compressors.
Yeah.
It just seems like there's a tremendous resurgence that kind of gives a nod to the, is it Paya, P-A-I-A?
Yeah.
Like they're the little fat man synths and stuff, or the Heath kit. If you if you want to go all the way back to the build it, do-it-yourself electronics. And in fact, the internet is a delivery mechanism for schematics, do-it-yourself information and guides, other users. I mean, you can be more connected now with other people who, for a variety of reasons, economic and sheer sadomasochistic reasons, they would choose to build their own compressors, mic trees, and otherwise. Are you finding, because I still think what you're doing really in some ways ties into this self-empowerment?
I think it definitely does. And it's funny because I actually really, that was kind of the direction that I wanted to take Black Lion Audio to begin with. I wanted to make it a resource for information for people and a place where they could come to find out how to modify this thing or that thing that they had. And it didn't really seem to work out that way, probably because, you know, we started modifying the FireWire interfaces and that just was about all we could handle based on the demand. So I still think to myself, like, I would love to, if I get the time, just kind of go through some stuff and say, well, here's what my recommendation is. You can do this and you can do that. Change out this part. But then at the same time, surface mount electronics makes things a lot harder for your average DIY person.
Yeah, I mean, the projects I saw for the... is impressive as it was, these kind of build-it-yourself SSL bus comp look-alike things.
Yeah.
It also looked kind of approachable. Like, it didn't totally intimidate me.
Right.
But then I look at the computer stuff and I see all these surface mounted chips and FireWire interfaces and driver issues. And I said, boy, there's a few extra levels of complexity that really
pulls beyond the realm of DIY.
Yeah.
I mean, even developing something like that is more than one person can do. I mean, you have a whole team of people that are working to bring this product to market. Whereas, you know, Bill Putnam, I bet for the most part, kind of worked on circuit design by himself. Maybe he had an assistant or two. You know, I don't really know his history too well, but it just, the complexity of things has definitely increased. I used to have a boss who complained about that so much. You know, it does definitely make things complicated. But then at the same time, I think if you grow up around it, or if you kind of have like an inquisitive enough mind, you will find information online that will help you to deal with these things. I mean,
but are you finding a more vibrant community of it? Or am I imagining that? Or are you seeing a little?
Well, not in pro audio. There's a hugely vibrant community of DIY folks that deal with digital stuff in the hi-fi world. And these are guys that I think the thing that I appreciate about them, for all their silliness sometimes, they get really wrapped up in some of the craziest, just far-out things. They have an incredible approach to experimentation that I don't find in pro audio. I think that to a degree, we're afraid to experiment because we're afraid of being lumped in with that crowd of people. But man, experimentation is kind of the heart of where it's at. You know, well, what, you know, just like saying to yourself, well, what about configuring it this particular way? Maybe it's not going to work, or maybe it will. Or, you know, what about trying this particular value here? You know, what about treating this from, you know, whatever perspective, like, yeah, I think that that's a really important thing that that the hi-fi community definitely can give to us as a as the pro audio community.
Now, let me ask you something about this, though. You, for instance, I'm going to go back a half a thought here. That you mentioned all the other big name converter brands that you've in some way listened to, investigated. Before you start this experimentation, are you finding in any way, though, that that there's a, I guess I'd call it a conventional wisdom in something like converter design.
There is where, a conventional wisdom.
Yeah. Where there's a, you know, a, some sort of striking similarity in the way that they all approach it.
Yeah, there is. There definitely is. And I think that a lot of that stuff is built up on, we build it up on practice. You know, we practice things a certain way because they're functional and they work. And they work for a mass mark, like a mass produced environment. So there's a reason why, definitely.
But even in the boutique-y ones.
Even in the boutique-y ones, I find a lot of the same things. It's, yeah, it'll just be, it just takes a little time. I think that things will, that, that practices will evolve. We'll start to understand a little more about digital, how to squeeze more performance out of it, how to minimize, you know, certain noises, like, the, some of the things I explained to you before we started the interview, like how certain noises happen, how to minimize those noises, how to maximize the dynamic range, you know. And of course, you don't get something for nothing, you know.
There's, I mean, within your philosophy, do you think that there's something about, and I want to leave this just totally open-ended, is there anything about, is it going to be higher sample rates? Is it going to be greater bit depths? Is it going to be more floating point? Is it, what, do you even have an inkling which direction you're going to pursue seeking this improvement within the converters?
Well, for now, I think for us, the direction that we've approached is just trying to maximize what's already there. We don't, you know, of course, we're not Sony or Philips or something like that. We don't have the research dollars to pursue, you know, a format similar to DSD or something like that, where, you know, DSD, for those of you that don't know, is, you know, it's kind of considered to be the new digital audio. You know, you've got a sampling rate of 2.82 megahertz, something like that, and then a bit rate of one.
One, yeah.
Right. Okay, well, here's the thing. Like, if you were to use traditional PCM audio, that bit rate or that sample rate of 2.822 megahertz is actually your bit rate at 24 bits, I believe, or very close to it. I don't know. I'll have to dig out a calculator and do the division. But, you know, so it's kind of interesting how something like that came about. You can kind of, you know, once you get into it and start to study, you can see how, oh, okay, I see how that's related. And somebody maybe just experimented and said, okay, well, if we do it this way, it seems to improve this thing. I think that, you know, just improving what we've got or what we have on the table at the at this point is definitely possible. It just takes a little bit of experimentation. And then for our part, I guess where it gets complicated is we say, well, do we want to share that information with everybody or do we want to charge money for it and build our and continue to build our company up on it? You know, that's kind of gets to be a little hairy. And I don't think that either direction is wrong. It's just you have to decide what's best for you as a company. So,
but there is something consistent in your approach, though. For instance, in the clock circuit, using the one transistor instead of multiple ones to get rid of that fluctuation,
right,
crosstalk, whatever the right term is for that. So you guys do have some sort of identifiable philosophy, identifiable sound, identifiable approach in a
right.
way.
Right. I think that we definitely do. I think it's identifiable and unique enough that we are, pursuing patents on some of our designs.
Oh, nice.
And it just remains to be seen what happens with that. You know, I mean, we're kind of, sometimes I look at things and I go, well, we're underdogs. I mean, we're surrounded by people who have so much more money than we do from a marketing perspective. And marketing really, for all intents and purposes, does drive our industry to a great degree. And so we kind of feel like, well, you know, who knows whether our work's going to be appreciated in 10 years or tossed by the wayside. You never can tell. You know, you just pursue it and do the best you can and hope that somebody takes notice.
It's odd that the biggest double-edged sword in pro audio or retail or music gear retail recently has been cheapish gear.
Right.
How, and again, the gamut is cheap mics, cheap compressors, cheap mix. There's a lot of mass produced stuff from Russia, from China, from wherever. The good news is some of it's actually decent. It's not all bad. Right. I mean, I don't want to seem uncritical listener. Some of it's dodgy. Probably the worst complaint is that its quality control is spotty, and one might be good and one might be bad. Although the funny thing is that the reality of that cheapish gear has been the best boon for Blacklight Audio, because you could take something that's prefabricated that way, and it's probably a lot less intensive to improve the op amps and to modify it than it would be for you to have to have done the whole design and production.
Right, exactly. That's the funny thing about this sort of approach, economically speaking, because it is cheaper to take a pre-existing piece of equipment and modify it, and you get more for your dollar than you do if you were to have just manufactured it that way to begin with, because of, like I mentioned before, the pricing structures and the way that the multiples of those pricing structures work. But then at the same time, someone might say, well, but the downside is that it's not marketed really. It doesn't have this sort of sex appeal. It doesn't have because a lot of marketing is there to create a perception in the industry and a perception of how this sounds and how the brand itself works or how it places the product, from an economic perspective makes pretty good sense. From a marketed perspective, maybe not. If you're running a studio in which you have $1 million of debt that you got to recoup somehow, and the way that you get people in the door is by name brands, you are not interested in Blacklight Audio because it doesn't have that sex appeal,
Although the irony, even though everything you said is true, I'm noticing when I see gear lists on any websites from any studios of any size, I'm noticing that the gear list comes more qualified now than ever. Such and such interface, modified.
That's true.
Such and such mic, modified.
Right.
I've never seen as much of that as I have recently.
It's totally true. And I think it's, it's just a mixed bag. There's a particular recording studio here in Chicago that we had approached, I think, when we had first designed our clock. And, when we designed this thing, we, of course, took the pains to kind of listen to maybe what some of our competitors were doing, not to steal their designs in any respect at all, because we weren't interested in that. We wanted to build something that we felt like was a better deal for the money and performed better. So we just wanted to hear what they sounded like.
Well, you have to know your competition.
Well, yeah. And, we offered this particular studio owner, hey, do you want to use one of these things? We'll set up an AB for you, whatever. Not interested in the least bit. No, I'm not interested in that because it doesn't have the name recognition that such and such a brand has. If some musician comes in my studio and wants to know if he's going to book time or is thinking about booking time, he's going to look at my rack of equipment and see that I have such and such a brand. And he knows that brand because of their marketing campaign. And so you know, he'll choose it. He'll choose my place because I have these particular pieces of equipment.
That has been the dirty little secret of bigger recording studios for a while. Is they, right. There are some. I'll qualify that. But there are some that are funded and set up less at the expertise of engineers who are listening and who give a shit about the sound and more about the what makes it more bookable.
About the dollar amount. And you know, again, it's a business. It's kind of one of those unfortunate things, but I hesitate to criticize too much because I just think, all right, well. You know, you are running a business, and if I had, you know, $300,000-$400,000, $500,000, $1 million in debt that I was trying to pay, I might look at the world a little bit differently. You know, I might be a little more stressed out about whatever.
It's the thing we've also heard 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times about the Pro Tools software. Mm-hmm. It's fine. There's a lot of other software that's just as capable and all of this and that, but some people are practically forced into having Pro Tools just because it's the only thing that you could say to a client coming in that makes them, you know, it's the only software they know. I can't say, well, Digital Performer does the same thing.
And, yeah, I know. Yeah. It's funny how that perception exists. It's really funny. Some people are humongous fans of Pro Tools. They really like the way that it works. They like the way that the editing features are set up, you know, and then of course there's complaints about it, you know, the lack of expandability, the fact that the pricing structure is really, for all intents and purposes, completely ridiculous in my mind. But at the same time, yeah, I can't criticize that too much because I've built up a business on exploiting that gap that they've created, you know. I don't know. If it were any other industry, I don't know if you would see these sorts of insane price differences. And then, you know, once you have a chance to kind of crack open the hood on both of these systems, you know, the LE system and their higher priced HD systems, and you see what's under, you know, how the circuit design has happened and, you know, what they've done with the LE system that sort of artificially exaggerates, you know, it sort of artificially... hampers the performance of the LE hardware in order to exaggerate the price difference between the LE and the HD. It's really just like, oh, that's just so, I don't know. It's just, but again, you know, we've made a business out of dealing with that.
So let's talk about you living in that gap for a while. You've wisely focused on interfaces for computer recording, clocks, and all those things that, and really they're relevant from everybody to a person who's just a single home composer all the way up to big studios. Mm-hmm. I mean, your products fill that whole range. I mean, of all the areas you might want to be in pro audio, stuff that helps people record to their computers is pretty much a good place to be.
Yeah, because that's the new staple over tape machines, I think, which is kind of unfortunate, but, you know, kind of not. I mean, there's, you give and you get, I guess.
How much, moving just a little way specifically from Black Lion Audio, but just to the industry in general, I guess this is crystal ball type. I mean, in what ways can you foresee the future being changed by the kind of empowerment that legitimately good sounding low price gear is really becoming available? Because, you know, prior to Black Lion Audio, you might have been able to say, well, the cheap gear is there, but it really is there's a sonic loss. There is really the price point, the price differentiation between the good stuff and bad stuff, for good or bad, it really did correlate with the quality.
Right.
And unnecessarily so, that must be your philosophy.
I think it's a little unnecessarily so, because when you sit down and figure out, well, okay, this particular product does it this way and this product does it that way, and there's $1,000 difference between the two, but when you break down the cost of the parts that differentiates that, you maybe come up with $20, you know?
Do you think musicians are currently, I guess, empowered by this, or do you even think musicians are able to critically listen enough to understand the nuances of what you're actually providing for them? I hope they are.
But I hope so. I you know, I would like to think so. We get enough positive emails from people and phone calls and stuff, you know, and so I'd like to think that there's something there. And we've the list of clients that we have that's how do I put this? The sort of people that, that are more at the top of the industry or that are higher up in the industry, I don't even know what I'm saying. Like, the sort of people that we're catering to at this point is
are more accomplished.
Are more accomplished people. We have managed to develop working relationships and do work for several people in the film industry, a lot of Grammy-winning engineers and producers. We typically don't brag about it on our website, which is something that's probably going to change, I guess, to kind of give people a little bit better idea of who we do work for. It's not, you know. So I think that hopefully it's going to have a positive impact on things. Now, how far-reaching that is, what effect it has on the marketability of something, on people's, you know, incomes on the bottom line. I guess my thought is that, or my hope is that it's going to take less investment in order to create something that sounds professional, not only for someone at home, but for someone in the industry altogether, like, you know, maybe working at it for a living. I'm hoping that that sort of savings will translate into, you know, maybe a little more feasibility for selling audio as a product or selling music as a product. Now, how we sort of overcome this, you know, apparent loss of the tangible product that we've been able to sell for the last, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. That's another hurdle that we're going to have to figure out how to overcome. But
I had two questions in mind. Now you've given me a third one.
Okay.
let me start at one point. Because you're working on the improving the AD and DA and so on and so forth in end clocks and in computer interfaces, you're in so many ways facilitating computer-based recording, which is where it's at. I mean, that's where it's going. You're improving the quality of that. Mm-hmm. But you also know the strengths and weaknesses of real outboard gear, other gear, proper studios, proper rooms, and other things that are in fact the rest of the equation, things that you... Or at least things relating to the room, acoustics, mic placement, there's a whole variety of other things that no matter how much you're using a computer that has some plugins and things like this, there's a variety of things you can't remove from the equation.
Right.
Let's start with the rest of the outboard gear. Do you have any thoughts about how independent people with just, you know, a laptop and a computer interface, to what degree are they replacing other gear, or to what degree is it still necessary to have some reverbs and compressors and actual pro audio hardware?
Well, yeah, I think that I just don't think that plugins really take the place of that stuff yet. Things may change over time, but I think that there's something to be said for a nice outboard compressor. And looking at your rack, I'd say you probably agree with me.
Yes. I'm biased. I know my answer to that question.
I just think that outboard gear just does something to the music. Like we were discussing earlier about mixing in the box versus mixing out of the box. And it just seems like if you're able to mix out of the box and you don't have to have the most complicated console set up in the world, you can do something as simple as a basic summing amplifier or a summing bus with a, you know, like a mic preamp, pair of mic preamps on it, to make up for the gain. It just has more dimension to it. It just feels to me like there's more air, there's more punch, there's more, all of the things that you really want in a nice mix, the palpability, the feeling of it.
And even if people would only hear one mix in and of itself and not understand how to get a comparative sense of it.
Right.
I think it translates into a less visceral kind of, like, so all of a sudden it just impacts you less physically and emotionally.
Right.
And at a certain point, any musician or engineer should be worried if there's something about the process, if there's something about doing, and I'm as computer geeky as you get, but I have to understand the limitations of this as a tool that I'm using to do it. And if there's something about the internal summing or whatever it would be, that's removing the impact of the music, it's you got to factor
it in. Yeah, I think that's definitely that's a powerful tool. I would say the one thing that maybe I would recommend most would be room treatment. Probably to start out with. I think that's so vital. A good room with nice acoustic treatment.
Now, since you deal with all the AD and DA coming in and out of the computers all the time, I would almost practically expect you to come up with some sort of a passive summing mixer. I mean, like, I could imagine that as a natural offshoot of your product line.
That's a good point. I actually looked into that, and I understand the design behind it. I think it's one of those things that I just never really took a step on. And we had developed this kind of a, I don't know, it's kind of an interesting relationship with the company that owns SM Pro, which is an Australian-based company.
Yeah. Yeah, because they have an SM8 or what is that
called? Yeah, it's a PM8. It's a passive mixer. And they sent me a couple when they started manufacturing them. And we did a couple of modifications for them for a few people, but we didn't really pursue offering it because it's actually fairly simple to do yourself. You know, if you know how to use a soldering iron, you can probably figure it out pretty quickly or send us an email. We'll tell you exactly what we did. And for the price, based on the components that were in there, it's actually not too bad, you know. I think it's $300 or something.
Oh, they're like way on the affordable side. Could I ask, is there differences in the Dangerous Music or the Fulcrum or the other ones?
Well, the biggest differences are probably going to be
quality of components.
I don't know. The SM Pro uses metal film resistors, but I've never looked inside the Dangerous mixer. I'm assuming that for the price you're getting a good metal film resistor or maybe a surface mount.
People that have film. That, they think that Mr. Muth has nailed it on that one.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think that it really makes a big difference. And then the amplifier, the summing amplifier, because essentially what you're doing is you're summing all these channels together and you have to make them pass over a resistor. The common value that most people use is 10K or 20K. The bigger the resistor, the more isolation you get across the channels. In other words, the less crosstalk you have. But then not only do you get more thermal noise from the resistor, but you also have your summing amplifier has to have more gain in order to make all that back up, right? So there's trade-offs like everything. But for the SM Pro, the pots to me looked pretty nice. And like I said, metal film resistors. We didn't really spend a whole lot of time in looking at the bus resistors to see exactly how well they performed, like in terms of thermal noise or what have you. But even if you had to replace all of them, I mean, you're talking about, I think, 16 of them in total. So, you know, that's not terribly hard. You can order 16 of the Vishay metal film resistors, which are, to me, among the best performing and least expensive metal film resistors that are out there.
Are opinions like what you're putting out now, are those commonly held opinions or have you suggested that some of your opinions or some of your approaches are slightly contentious amongst the audio?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I would say probably when it comes to pro audio, like if you asked of like 10 different engineers, which metal film resistors do you like better? You might get someone who would say, I don't see what difference any of it makes. You'd get me who says, I like the Vishay metal film resistors. You probably get somebody who says, I like the old Holco resistors that are in all the Neumann stuff from the 50s or 60s. You know, it's just kind of everybody's opinion really is all it is. It's like asking, I don't know, three or four different chefs, what's the best way to make a pumpkin pie? Everybody is, they all know what they're doing, but they all probably have their own opinion. So to me, the reason the basis for my opinion is the cost, because they're about 8 cents each individually. And if you buy like, you know, 10 or more, the price drops. The AC impedance over the frequency band is really good. The thermal noise performance is really good. In other words, they're not noisy. Like carbon film resistors are going to be really noisy. They sound really good. They have this weird effect where they kind of exaggerate like the second harmonic and they kind of distort it a little bit, but the trade-off is that they're noisy. So when you're dealing with 10K values, you know, 16 of them placed across a bus, you know, it all gets additive. So it's, it can become a problem.
I will ask you this just because it's, I guess I've got to be that, I got to bring some drama to the interview.
Okay.
I couldn't emphasize enough how much unilateral, how consistently and just across the boards, everything I heard from people was so strangely good about their results about Black Lion Audio. It was startling. In fact, it would be fair not inappropriate to mention that even the other mods from the Womb site, who are accomplished good audio people, mm-hmm. even they were enthusiastic because the people that haven't had the occasion to mm-hmm. to work with a Black Lion modded mm-hmm. interface, the reputation is strongly positive. Mm-hmm. You've also had some small amount of criticisms too, mm-hmm. I suppose. I think yeah. that must be very much in the minority because I'm truly having trouble remembering.
Well, that's that. There.
But what kind of hurdles have you run into from anybody who is just, I don't know. I don't know what kind of hurdles you would run into in your efforts.
There's
to do
a few
this.
Different hurdles. Most of them tend to be, I think, technical in nature. When I say technical in nature, what I mean is that sometimes we run into people who have somewhat of a technical background and have decided for some reason that they're going to be the hero of the day and show everybody on whatever forum why we're the biggest liars since the dawn of time. And suddenly they've saved mankind from a huge, scam or something. I don't know. And I've gotten in arguments with, usually I try to not mess with it, but sometimes it gets to be a little silly. You know, if we're losing business over it, which certainly does happen sometimes, then sometimes I'll step in. We had a guy probably 2 or 3 years ago that was making all these just, I don't know, kind of silly claims. And like his premise was faulty. So like, you know, he's starting from this particular premise and he's making these claims, which are true premise correct, but the premise was incorrect. So it sounds like he knows what he's talking about. And a little bit he does, but he also kind of doesn't. So I step in and I say, you know, well, yeah, I don't think you know what you're talking about and blah, blah, blah. Oh, you know, it turns into this big, dumb argument. So then I say, you know, well, you're quoting everything from this particular spec when in fact we're actually using this other one over here. We're powering from this particular perspective. So, yeah, it gets a little silly sometimes because I think probably having a somewhat of an artistic personality, I take that stuff very personally.
Well, it's got to be difficult because, you know, I don't have to tell anybody who's been on the internet more than, you know, an hour that people are such jerks.
I know.
There's a sense of the anonymity and mm-hmm. all this other stuff that can bring out people's mm-hmm. worst nature.
Oh yeah,
and,
I know.
And I have a delightful time 99% of the time, mm-hmm. but every once in a while somebody is, people treat you in a way that I don't think that they would treat you in real life and face to face. And I think eventually there will be some cultural shift to where people on the internet and people in real life have come to some sort of an agreement where it's not two dichotomous different right. cultures.
No, I agree with you. I think that that's definitely true.
In your case, though, I'm only bringing it up because if you're so based on word of mouth advertising mm-hmm. and forums, these interactions, good, bad, and otherwise, mm-hmm. are directly related to how you are able to make a living, how right. you're able to work, how you're able to get the truth about what mm-hmm. your mods are, how they work, how they perform, yeah. and it becomes extremely important for that for you to have a yeah. clear line of communication.
It's crazy sometimes. Some days I feel like I'm getting held hostage by people because we've literally had people demand that we do certain things for them. Or they're going to post all over the forums that were this, that, or the other thing, you know, like just really nothing short of extortion. You know, and you kind of are like, well, what do I do? You know, I mean, in a way you go, okay, well, I want, you know, we work hard to make sure that people are happy and we try to help people out as best as we can. But, you know, that's going a little far. Like, we're not going to give you free overnight shipping just because you want it, you know, or just because you're threatening us with something, you know. That certainly happens sometimes.
Should I presume that earlier in the history of Black Lion Audio, there still was probably a period where you were experimenting or learning to consistently do the mods, but now, I mean, it's got to be at this point you've seen these interfaces. Now you guys have to have it down to like a pretty perfect system.
We know, especially with the like well, pretty much with everything, we know the more you do it, the better you get, right? And so
it would just have to be.
Yeah, you would say, okay, well, we know that this particular company's interfaces have these problems. Okay, so how do we make sure that we avoid those problems? How do we make sure the reliability factor is there? Because that's very important to us. We don't want to, nobody wants to have this situation where they perform a service for someone where, you know, everything's coming back to you because of some problem. So we definitely work hard to make sure that that the quality and the reliability are there. But
isn't that, as you guys have become, as you've done these repairs more and more, you've mm-hmm. become, you've got a very sophisticated take on it. You've become
right.
very practiced at it.
Yeah.
I would think that any surprises or breakage, it has to happen less and less. Now you know enough about how to pack it,
right,
how to do
right.
it. I mean, I'm sure even just shipping has got to be a big pain.
Shipping
in the butt.
Even shipping is difficult. And we have pretty strict policies on shipping, and they exist for people's benefit and for ours as well. I think the first year we were doing this on any sort of grand scale, we had like 3 package claims with UPS, 3 instances where something was destroyed. And the second year we did it, that dropped. I think we had 1. This year so far, we've had really nothing to speak of, you know, because we understand more and more, how do you pack this? Okay, if something comes in, and you'd be amazed how people pack their stuff sometimes, you know, just naked in a box by itself. And you're like, how did this even arrive here in working order? So we make sure that it's certainly not going to go out that way, even to the point where we may have to charge you a little bit extra. Because if you come back to us with something damaged in shipping, it's a much different conversation than if you're a little mad over $30 extra. You know, it's just, it's like any business. Like, you, there are unique challenges to doing something over the internet, and something that involves that much shipping, you know, because our customer base is all over the world. And there are unique challenges to dealing with other cultures, I have found. We noticed that, because we get a lot of work from Europe and Canada, and Canadian customers have very unique expectations of service that American customers do not have. And sometimes there is just differences in culture. So, you know, like, they might get offended because we do something a certain way. And we're thinking, well, why are you offended about that? We do that for everybody, you know, or we don't do that for anybody or whatever. And European customers have their own take on things, you know. The Scandinavians are very unique in the way that they approach a business transaction, you know. The Germans are very unique in the way that they approach a business transaction. So you definitely learn to deal with other cultures. And fortunately, we have a couple people that work for us who are pretty well traveled and have lived in other countries, and they kind of help us in dealing with that sort of cross-cultural boundary that we have to, you know, that we have to deal with. It's very interesting.
Well, let me ask you this then, kind of as we get toward the end of this interview, just as musicians are working on computer, I keep coming back to computers because mm-hmm. that seems to be the principal, so
right.
much of a principal focus for mm-hmm. the services you provide.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain weirdness, a certain cultural disassociation in the idea that musicians are now using iTunes and digital distribution mm-hmm, methods, mm-hmm. and there's no physical media
right.
for the transfer of musical
mm-hmm.
information.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the same way I'm recording this, I've got a laptop and a 2 terabyte hard drive over
mm-hmm,
there. I'm recording
mm-hmm.
to it. It's, you know, there's no thing. There's no wax cylinder spinning
right.
here in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
No tape reels. Can you tell me anything about what you think, how Black Lion is going to continue to affect the industry in terms of empowerment, mostly in terms of empowerment for
mm-hmm.
independent musicians, or how the continued use of computer recording and the lack of physical media
mm-hmm.
is also going to be part of this transformation
mm-hmm.
of possibly a music industry where if people are getting affordable but high
mm-hmm.
quality but
mm-hmm.
affordable interfaces,
mm-hmm.
they can record themselves and they can distribute themselves.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see the effects of what you're doing relating to this whatever it is we're guessing that the mm-hmm. music industry is going to turn itself into as it's going through this transitional phase.
Well, I think that...
Because clearly the old model's gone. We can agree to that.
Unfortunately gone, yeah.
Unfortunately?
Well, I am the biggest fan of LP records. And I think that like it's kind of too bad that that's no longer a prominent medium for music, because I love the way that they sound. But so I guess I shouldn't say unfortunately, because you know it's just a different time, and I think as musicians we have to rise to meet the challenge. I think that I think the biggest thing is the economic feasibility of our industry and how the model is changing. What is the feasibility? How do we make our money? What do we invest in order to make our money? And, you know, if the humongous studio is kind of, well, they're becoming fewer and fewer. I have a friend, well, not a friend, but more like an associate who was a repair technician at a pretty large facility in California and lost his job because... You know, studios like that are going under all over the place. But it doesn't mean that that we as musicians have to. And it's not the death knell for us, I guess. It's it just means that things are changing. I think that we definitely have to be smarter about what we invest in, how we invest our money. In terms of our equipment, one of the difficult things about recording on a computer is that the recoupability of the hardware diminishes pretty dramatically over a very short period of time. So, you know, like let's say that we buy the most current Macintosh computer and the newest interface from, you know, whatever company. In 10 years, it's not like a tape machine where, you know, if a studio invested in a tape machine, you know, they would have a tech on hand to repair that because it was a big investment, but it was also going to last them for a long, long time. You know, nowadays, if you're recording on a TDM system, people are like, what's wrong with you? You know, get into the modern day or whatever, you know?
I'd hate to be the last guy to spend $30,000 on the TDM system right before the HD systems came out.
And there were people that did that. I know. I read some stories about a guy that did that. I don't know. It's just, I think that the age of humongous investments every few years in equipment is not feasible, like in a base model of equipment. And I think that by minimizing that investment and sticking with whatever system you've got for a little while, it frees you up to invest in products that do have a long performance life. Good microphones. I mean, those are never going to go out of style. They're never going to be outdated, at least not in any foreseeable way that I can imagine. Good outboard gear, like your nice Eventide here that you have. I mean, that's probably something you're going to be using for years and years and years because it sounds good. So,
and I think good converters are an important part of the chain, but it often has been discussed on forums. Some people are asking about AD converters extremely prematurely, mm-hmm. and they're properly reminded, if only slightly scolded, mm-hmm. by those who said, well, have you taken care of the room treatments? Have you taken care of, have you gotten through this in the list of priorities in mm-hmm. proper order? Like you get a good performance, get the good mic, get the mm-hmm. good pre. The converter might be the next thing on the list, maybe, but there's things on top of that list.
Yeah. I think our goal was to make that a little bit easier to obtain. And from a financial perspective, it frees up your budget to do other things for you. To obtain the good room treatment, which I think is incredibly important to get the decent mics.
And if I didn't say this already, this interview is being recorded through a Blackline Audio modded Motu interface. And after the mod, I'm not embarrassed to have this be the thing that I use when I'm just dragging around my laptop and I want to have a portable solution. Mm-hmm. After the mod, it's really an extremely reasonable interface to have.
I think that it's a pretty good deal. And you've got the... Original 896, if I'm not mistaken, is the same one that I have. It's one of my favorites that they make.
It doesn't have the Q mix in it, but I'm not doing this rig.
But it's not. I mean, for what you get for the price for the A to D conversion, it's pretty hard to beat.
I like the metering on the front is why I picked that instead of the. I had two other FireWire options, but I picked that instead just so I could just look down and see what's going.
There's
on.
There's a whole host of things I really like about those. One of them is the nice R-Core transformer that they're using in the power supply. That's pretty unusual and it's really cool. So.
And you did mention that in some of the products or whatever that you're coming out with, this was on your video interviews, you mentioned something was going to be Mac only because it had to do with the drivers. And I was going to ask in about how that played into your...
And
I am a Mac advocate. I guess I should mention, I own three Macs and I like them. I'm conversant in other computer, in quite a few other computer platforms, but... But then it becomes a reasonable consideration with your tools.
Right.
Things like, who does have drivers that you can really use?
The biggest thing when it comes to putting out a computer interface, somebody like Mark of the Unicorn has got this nailed because they have so much, they put so many resources into their software support that their drivers are pretty awesome, I think, for Mac. Anyway, I really don't use PC very much, so I... but for us, like if we were going to do an interface, and I would love to at some point in time do something, we're so small that you can't, when it comes to doing drivers for PC, I mean, there's so many variations in hardware and what, this doesn't work with the NEC chipset or you got to have the TI chipset or what Ethernet card are you using or what, all these little things can create problems, and Macintosh tends to be quite a bit easier. And one of the companies that we had talked to about doing working on a system with us is the company here in town that I mentioned earlier. They're called Sentrance, and they do driver work for a number of different companies. And I said, well, what's it like? What's your support ratio like? And they said it's like 90% PC and 10% Mac, and for the Mac ones it's always like the same problem, people forget to turn the internal microphone off and turn the USB thing on. So it's just, I think for somebody like us, we don't want to get swamped in software support. We just couldn't handle it. There's no way I couldn't hire enough people. It wouldn't be economically feasible for enough for us given the sort of model that we're trying to approach. So, that's why I had said probably Mac only because of the,
now I'm going to go back a half a thought and presume at this point that the person listening to this, let's say they're, a self-recording musician or band, they're interested. Mm-hmm. Let's say they've gotten or will be getting a Blackline Audio modded interface. Mm-hmm. If they've listened to the bare end, then they're going to get one, and it's well worth it. I'm trying to be objective and say it's a startling difference for the cost. It's an amazingly startling difference in quality. It's amazing how much that is money well spent. And if you do any amount of audio, you owe it to yourself to consider that. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I guess this is a philosophical kind of a business question. Mm-hmm. If you're a self-recording person, we're in a world where every teenager, every kid thinks the internet still exists for free music and porn.
Right.
And we're recording everything with it to computers with the idea that we'll be using digital delivery, that might be the difference. Mm-hmm. Without the expense required to press records or press CDs, warehouse them, distribute them, and sell them, by removing those components of the chain, that's part of the empowering sense, whether people are, we're using Snowcap or if they're using iTunes or other either delivery digital delivery services or mechanisms. What is the other one?
There's eMusic. I don't know if you're familiar with that one or not.
I wonder, there's one other CD Baby-like service, I just can't place the name, but it's another with an incredibly good deal for the musicians, and if I remember the name, I would heartily encourage to investigate them as well. Mm-hmm. But do you have any thoughts on, as you empower people with these with better-sounding interfaces to record and deliver things digitally, do you even have a crystal ball moment about what's going to happen in the industry as people try to use computers to make reasonable living, not MTV Cribs ridiculous living.
Because this stuff that's not even real. Like that's not real. That's I don't know. I wish that I knew. I've been thinking about this and thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it.
I'm mildly obsessed with the topic, but I don't have something that feels like the real answer to me yet. It's that sense of how will the industry reform in a way where it's truly viable to make a living. Your products so fit into this scheme of empowered, independent, you know, recording, and it would fit in with the music industry 2.0 perfectly. And I've just continued to explore the ways how can people get music out digitally and still convince teenagers to actually pay for things reasonably, especially if you remove that argument that it's all going to some big, bad, evil record company. Yeah, no, you're really supporting the actual band.
I think that's such a tough question, because like you think about, okay, well, Radiohead's new record, all right?
Didn't only half of the people or a third of the people just didn't even pay for it at all? A startling percentage paid nothing.
A huge amount of people that didn't pay for it. I was one of those people that didn't pay for it, I'm sorry to say.
And I think I picked $15. Mm-hmm. I picked something that was, maybe it was 12, whatever seemed to be like the normal price for a full CD. I said, I'm just going to pay current market price because I could sleep better if I feel like I did that.
Probably should have done that. I think my plan was to wait for the tangible product to come out and then actually purchase that, which I still haven't done. So, you know, you can all judge me quietly at home during this interview. In a way, I feel like, because like so many people in the press were like, oh, you know, this is a new moment or whatever, you know, like heralded it as this thing that it really wasn't, I don't feel like. Because, I mean, it's kind of smug to be able to, and sorry, Radiohead, I don't mean to insult you, but it's kind of smug to be able to sit there and say, well, we're going to do such and such, and we'll let our record be downloaded for whatever you want to download it for, when they have an enormous fan base as a result of the promotional arm of the record industry.
I said all the same stuff about Prince or whatever. They said he was a slave to the record companies, but only after they made him rich.
Right. It's just, so it's kind of, it's, I think the, if you can come up with a solution that allows the the average Joe who's really pursuing a career in music to be able to sell some sort of tangible product, I think you'd probably be a rich person. I don't know.
Because that's what I'm rooting for, and I'm trying to figure out how to practically.
I think here in Chicago, there's a record label called Drag City, and then there's a record label called I can't think of what they're called. Tortoise is on this label, and there's a number of local acts. And the approach that they've taken is that they press records. They press vinyl records of everything, and they give you a free CD. But I don't really see how that's... It doesn't seem to be like a long-term solution to me.
In fact, I continue to question what the precise role of record companies will be in the future.
Well, I think they're definitely going to be diminished. Since, like I mentioned earlier with my friend that works at Warner Brothers, you know, new media, ringtones. I mean, it just is, really
you
bizarre.
You didn't say that on the mic.
Yeah. I have a friend who works at Warner Brothers in their new media division. And it's a fairly profitable new segment from what I understand. And they mostly deal with things like ringtones. And you know, I think we had discussed earlier how there is there's a debate over whether or not artists even are going to get paid for those ringtones, which is really a shame, you know, because, hey, it's, you wrote the song, you should, you know, it's difficult in a way because we're saying, okay, well, we're removing the control that this one particular industry has on, or this one particular group of companies has on the industry. We're taking that control away from them, and we're giving it to the individual artist, you know, in terms of like the distribution media. But nobody's come up with a viable solution to get paid for that distribution. And it's one of the reasons why the big companies are starting to fall apart and to have difficult times. And I think, to me, it makes me raise an eyebrow. Okay, if there's a way to make money in a particular industry, you better believe that somebody's going to figure out how to do it. So I think I'm just waiting and trying to figure out myself, like, how is this feasible? I can think of like how I could say, well, I can take on, you know, these particular bands that are already established that I know of that are looking for record labels. They are marketable. They're sellable. You know, they sell products. They tour extensively. And I can see how I can take them on as a, some sort of management thing, you know, and just kind of help them manage their, the monetary aspect of what they're doing. But I don't know how to promote someone who's just starting out. That's what I can't figure out.
And I also don't know to what degree is the problem within the industry in the way that we have to change the model and change what we're doing, and to what degree is the problem a widespread public perception of music as a commodity and that music should be free on the internet.
Right.
Like I don't know how to even combat that reasonably. And you can't, and I'm not asking about other DRM or any of that stuff, because you can't come up with a technological solution for a behavioral problem.
I know, really, yeah, that's the difficult thing. In a way, it's sad that it's come to what it's come to. I mean, it has a benefit and a downside. On one hand, I think to myself, okay, here's an industry who has repeatedly cheated people out of money that they're owed. Who has, you know, come up with clever ways to scheme and deprive people of royalties that are otherwise due them.
It's properly earned its bad reputation.
Yeah. And now you're going, oh, please use the honor system. Yeah, right. You kind of are getting what you deserve. But then at the same time, like, there's all these innocent victims, like all these artists who, you know, like I listened to this interview with Bob Newhart on public radio, and they were talking about his... that Grammy award-winning comedy album that he made like in the 60s. And they said, well, did you make a lot of money on that? And he said, no, I think my royalty was 25 cents a record and I almost never got any money. And he said, when I ordered an outside audit of the records, the record company said, well, we don't have any because there was a fire that destroyed all the records in the ends. You know, like just these dirty little tricks that you're like, that's really... just abhorrent. So I don't know.
Well, I guess whatever the answer is, we're probably both going to be there through it.
I know.
We both seem to be rooting for the same thing.
Yeah.
Whatever that reasonable success is. And I do think that if you give good quality interfaces that are affordable to real humans, and we set the expectation that bands that are good and clever and work hard can find a way to make a reasonable living, and it won't be the MTV mansions, but you can make a reasonable living. There's a way that I would like to believe that we could both be part of the reformation of a proper music industry that's more equitable and realistic.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. I think one of the things that I have a friend who runs a small record label and does tour and perform, and I think he has this really interesting approach in that I just feel like he's not a rock star, you know, he just isn't, and he doesn't portray himself that way. And he makes a living, you know, he doesn't work. He's got a wife and kids and he makes money off of his music. But I think that these icons of the past, these like idols, that the music industry constructed in the 60s and 70s, those are dead. You know, I think that the ones that they construct nowadays are completely plastic, and it's almost disgusting to see how they not only exploit the people that are the artists, but they also exploit the crowd that's purchasing the product, you know, that's buying into the hype. Pretty much one of the worst things I think I've seen. That's
even in styles of music, whether I like it or don't like those styles, there's certainly is an odd sense that more things are manufactured and done up by the advertising and the makeup and the wardrobe and I remember seeing maybe it was a Journey video or something many years ago, and I went, those are some damn ugly musicians.
Yeah.
But there is something very nice about the time when it was about the music and musicians, and whatever they looked like was more of a secondary concern.
Right. I agree with you. It's really kind of a shame that things have moved in that direction. I wish that there was an answer that I had, because I certainly would. I'd certainly share it with you. So,
well, let me ask you this then, just to truly wrap up. So we know you've went from modifying interfaces to modifying more interfaces to finally making your own Blackline audio products, including mm-hmm. a high quality word clock and an AD converter. And then I think there's other things. Is there anything else you could tell us? Generally, oh, come on, anybody that's listened this long, give them a hint as mm-hmm. to what we should be expecting to see from Blackline audio in the near future.
Perhaps. Hopefully, well, I'm working on a mic preamp. Of all the things, I know there's like a ton of them out there. What I designed was I've always had this fascination with John Graham Cohen's double balanced circuit topology that was used as the basis for the SSL and a couple of other really popular mixing consoles. And so I took that. It's taken on a new sort of incarnation, a little bit different than what he was doing, and then I am using a transformer on the output. So we're hoping that we'll probably be able to do two channels for around 375, 380, something like that, which I think is pretty darn good. Tons of headroom, probably around, depending on what the final design is like, 30 to 33 dB of headroom, which is, you know, comparable to, you know, maybe something you'd buy from John Hardy or something like that.
So. Wow, yeah, because you're in the same price range then maybe as the FMR stuff.
Yeah. It's a similar, a different circuit design, but kind of similar business model, I think.
I could imagine so. Yeah. At least they seem like a good little company.
Yeah, that guy is, I think he's really done some awesome things for the home recording industry and made a bit of money at it too. So I guess, you know, it's
we'll just say then hooray for the folks that are really bringing truly high quality gear just because they're driven to, just because they've got that fire in them to do gear right and a certain pride in doing it right. And it's nice to have that back again at a price that some regular humans can afford. It's just, you know, it's not definitely ridiculous. We're not all, you know, what's that joke going? The thing you never hear at the end of a rock concert is that the sound guy's Lamborghini out back?
Exactly.
We're not going to our super mansions. We want to have good gear at a reasonable cost. Blackline right. Audio since 2003 has been doing that. And so with that, I want to thank Matt Newport, President, CEO, and Big Chief Honcho at Blackline Audio here in Chicago, Illinois, for joining us on WOOM Radio.
Well, thanks a lot.